This is a session on classical Christian mysticism. Actually, it's an introduction to classical Christian mysticism, sort of an opportunity for me to share with you some of the assumptions undergirding the writings of the great Christian mystics of the medieval and the early modern period. Ideally, this would be one of three or four sessions, in that we would spend one session laying out assumptions, and then we would spend a session on each of the major thinkers in the mystical tradition. But as is often true at Holden, things are not ideal. And so I'm just going to give you some background. To begin with, mysticism itself is a term that covers a wide variety of phenomena. It is a catch-all term. Roughly speaking, mysticism in the Western Christian tradition describes or refers to some direct, unmediated relationship between an individual and the divine. Direct, unmediated relationship. Now, some scholars have asked whether mysticism is a universal human phenomenon. There is no doubt that most religious traditions have something that resembles Christian mysticism. And it may well be that there is something fundamentally human about the mystical experience. By the way, in something like this at Holden event, you should feel free to interrupt and ask questions along the way. You can go like this if things are getting too high, far over people's heads, or if it's too elementary, you can go like that. And there are other gestures you can use, but they're not polite. Some of you may be familiar with Dr. Herbert Benson's work. He's at the medical school at Harvard University on the relaxation response. He found that repeating a word, a single word or a phrase over and over again, synchronizing the breathing, doing abdominal breathing, and trying to clear your mind of all distracting thoughts, essentially letting things go, will actually cause a bodily change in human beings. Certain, I think it's endorphins are released, blood pressure changes, beta rhythms change in the brain, and so on. And people normally describe this experience as being quite pleasant. And it may well be that that the relaxation response is at the heart of at least early phases of classical mystical traditions, because they use many of the same techniques. That is, regular breathing, concentration on a word or phrase, so-called mental prayer, and allowing all distracting thoughts and physical sensations to sort of pass you by. So it may be a universal, or at least parts of it, a universal human response, but there is no such thing as pure experience. We always experience the world mediated through our language, through our linguistic and cultural assumptions. And so Christian mysticism is different from, say, Jewish mysticism or Buddhist mysticism. It may have, we don't know, a similar experience at base, but it is since it's understood in a Christian context by Christians undergoing the experience, it has its own peculiar Christian characteristics. Why should we be interested in traditional mysticism? I think this is a question that I sometimes get in the classroom. I certainly would expect to get it here. Why not just study current writers on mysticism? Or why not study non-Christian forms of mysticism? Let me give you a couple reasons. One, the traditional mysticism gives a form of the mystical experience and the mystical discipline which is compatible with the Christian beliefs and practices of the larger non-mystical Christian population. So that's one reason. Another is the classics are, in a sense, time-tested. They have been used for a long time. They have inspired generations of people and have the capacity, I think, to inspire future generations. Another reason is that even though most of us might not ever aspire to a mystical experience. The early stages of the mystical ascent is a prayer life that I think we all should probably cultivate. That is, that early parts of the mystical discipline are simply the discipline of prayer. In any case, since we are living in the 20th century, and most of the mystics we'll be talking about today lived at least 400 or 500 years earlier, it is necessary for us to engage in what I term a critical reappropriation of the tradition. Basically, in our society, we operate with certain assumptions about the way the world works, about religion, about relations between human beings, and relations between human beings and God. These assumptions might be termed background theories. These assumptions or background theories are almost go unquestioned. The same is true in the medieval and the early modern period. They operated with certain assumptions which colored their description of the mystical experience. And these assumptions in many cases are different than ones we operate with today. And so it is necessary for us in a way to be able to separate out some of the background theories from the essence of the teaching. And I think this is true with Christianity generally. Let me give you a couple of examples. I'll go into more detail in a moment. You'll see the differences. They operate with a notion of hierarchy, that the world is structured hierarchically and that there are natural God-given differences among human beings. Some people are more noble than others. We don't operate largely with that assumption. They operated with the natural assumption of patriarchy, that males should be superior to females. That is at least under question today. They were relatively suspicious of the world and of the body. That is, they took a more Hellenic view of the world with a body, soul, spirit, matter dichotomy. Many today are trying to reach a more Hebraic notion of the whole human being and a greater appreciation of the creation. And so there are assumptions that they operate with that we do not. And so in taking their ideas and critically reappropriating them, we have to in some ways factor in the change in background theories. And so what I want to do today is lay out for you some of the assumptions, some of the background theories. Maybe they're not background, maybe they're foreground in some places, but some of the assumptions that operate in this writing, so that if you then want to pick up and read someone like St. Bernard of Clairvaux, or Meister Eckhart, or Teresa of Avila, or any of a number of mystical writers during this period, you will have a framework in which you can place their ideas. Some of the concepts will be familiar to you. I might also mention that this book, this is my copy, but the library now, I don't know if it's out actually on the shelf, has ordered this book called Christian Spirituality, The Essential Guide to the Most Influential Writings of the Christian Tradition. What it is sort of a cliff notes for the Christian set. It's 4 or 5 page praises of some of the greatest, with a little biographical sketch, and then praises of some of the great writings in the Christian spiritual tradition. So that if you're interested in Meister Eckhart, or Hildegard of Bingen, or Mechthild, or any number of mystics, you can look them up here, read about their writings, and decide whether you would like to pursue it further. So I commend this to you. Okay, what I'm going to deal with now for most of the rest of the session is background assumptions that are operating in mysticism. Now, those of you in the Sojourn group are reading at least excerpts from Teresa of Avila, and these assumptions may help you in your reading. Some of you here, especially in the long-term staff, may have had, because of the topics last summer, may have had opportunity to read Matthew Fox's original Blessing, in which he advocates a number of these mystical writers. I think he misunderstands a number of them. His heart is in the right place. I'm not sure where his head is located. And so that perhaps with these assumptions, you might go back and take a look again at some of the mystics that Fox commends, especially Meister Eckhart, who is Fox's favorite. The first assumption that seems to underlie most of the mystical writings of this period is what I've called a dualistic view of the world. That is, most of the Christian mystics of the medieval and the early modern age thought of the world in terms of spirit and matter, the body in terms of the soul and the spirit, or the spirit and the flesh. God, it was felt, was unchanging spirit, not changing matter. So God is spirit. Spirit is in some way perfect and immortal. That's why the human soul, which is seen as being spirit as well, is thought to be immortal, because it's unchanging in a certain way, whereas matter is imperfect and changing. The human being is both spirit and matter, body and soul. All right, so that's one assumption, that you can slice the human being this way. And this is an assumption that will then be later challenged by Luther, and I think is an assumption which some of us today have difficulty with. As you'll see in a moment when we take the notion of dualism and apply it with hierarchy, the soul is seen as superior to the body, and within the soul, certain aspects of the soul are superior to others. All right, so that's one assumption they operate with. And I can give you some examples in a little bit. The second assumption that they operate with is what I've called the principle of likeness. Likeness. Medieval men and women assumed, and based largely on Neoplatonic philosophy, they assumed that to know God directly, or better, to unite with God in the mystical union, one had to become like God. That is, in order to become, to know God, or to unite with God, one had to become like God. So this is an absolutely crucial notion. Since, for this reason, then, they believe that the body and the material world must be surmounted, must be overcome, in order to become more like God. And I'll give you some examples of this in a few minutes. Further, because of this belief that you had to become like God, most of the mystics assumed that within each human being there was some part of the soul which was like God, some part of the soul that had not suffered the corruption of the fall, some goodness that was still there, some anthropological resource by which one could reach God. A tiny, uncorrupted remnant of the pre-fall creation. They argued about, they said that this, when the human being was created in the image and likeness of God, the image and likeness was in the soul, and especially this part that had not suffered the taint of original sin. They call this uncorrupted resource a variety of different things. The Seelengrund, the ground of the soul, or the soul's ground. The Synteresis, or the spark, the divine spark. And you will find in St. Teresa, when she talks about the seven mansions and that God is in the seventh innermost mansion, she's referring to this place where God is located. Or when Eckhart talks about the ground, or the ground of the soul, there's this notion of this resource that is like God. And so, like peeling an onion, the individual has to move away from the material world, that which is not like God, the material world, the body, the senses, the will, the intellect, moving inward until eventually they can come to that part where they can meet God within the heart of their own soul, or in the center of their own soul. Today, in the reading from Henry Naunen in the morning, where he talks about solitude and rejecting the false self. He's in fact using modern language to describe the same process of stripping away that which is not like God and moving towards that which is like God. Now, given these dualistic assumptions and this principle of likeness, but especially the dualistic assumptions, it should not surprise you that most of the mystics of this period were clergy, were monks or nuns or priests, or were, even though they had not, they may not have taken actual vows, they were living lives of celibacy, poverty, self-denial, extreme ascetical practices. This was seen as the superior form of life because it was a life that was denying the body, denying the senses, denying those things that were not like God, and preparing oneself then to move towards that which was like God. Another assumption, any questions about this? I mean, those of you who are Lutheran, as we'll see in a moment, we're going to close with Luther's reaction to a lot of this. Luther completely rejects the notion of likeness, that you have to become like God to be saved. And that's one of the reasons why he is relatively suspicious of mystics. But we'll talk about that in a minute. The third guiding assumption is the assumption of hierarchy. That is, men and women in this period viewed the world, both the religious, the political, the social, and viewed human beings in hierarchical terms. That is, heaven itself was hierarchically graded with the choirs of angels, and some angels were superior to others, were better than others, and they were the ones that were allowed to sing most, you know, closest to God. On earth, there was a hierarchy, the spiritual hierarchy. The Pope was at the top, and then the cardinals, and then bishops, and so on, moving down. And in the secular world, the emperor, the king was at the top, and then the nobles, and so on. Now, this was so built into their way of viewing the world that they couldn't question it. I mean, it was built in. Democracy was another word for anarchy to people in this period. To give you an example, Hildegard of Bingen, a favorite also of Matthew Fox, a wonderful Neoplatonic mystic who uses feminine imagery to describe the divine, and an important resource for women trying to recover a tradition, critically reappropriate a tradition which helps them understand themselves within the Christian tradition. She was an aristocrat. She lived in the 12th century, and she was a Benedictine, belonged to a Benedictine order of nuns, and as was true with most Benedictine orders at that time, they accepted only girls from the most noble of families. And so at one point, another abbess took her to task for this view of things, for this practice, and she responded with considerable zest, defending this practice and pointing to the fact that hierarchy existed among people, among beasts, and among the angels in heaven, and that it was perfectly appropriate for her as a good Christian to take only the best and more noble people into her monastery. And in her allegories, in which she describes the vices and the virtues and personifies them, the virtues are always personified as nobles, noble ladies or noble lords or knights. The vices are always peasants and common people, because it was simply assumed that virtue went with the more noble in society and vice with the more base and common. So this is just a view built in to the way in which they describe and understand their experience. It's important to realize that the human being was also seen in hierarchical terms. That is, there was the human being had better and worse parts. At the lowest level was the body, and next there were the animal senses, and then above that were certain appetites, and then there was the will, and finally the intellect. And the intellect was seen as superior to the will superior to the animal appetites, and the appetites and senses superior to the body, and so on. And that, so that the highest part of the human being And here, mystical theologians disagreed. The highest part was the part that was to be united with God in the mystical union. In some cases, it would be the mind. Other cases, it would be the will. And so even, as it were, their notion of physiology influenced the way in which they described and understood the mystical exercise.
Mark, you said something that confused me. When you said the mystics disagreed, did they disagree among themselves?
Yes.
Okay.
Among themselves. They were different. There's a number of different schools. I will be simplifying it into a couple, but mystics rarely agree completely with each other.
Did they call themselves mystics then? I mean, was that?
No. The terminology varies. They call themselves contemplatives. There was a long argument in the medieval period which was described in terms of Mary and Martha, the story of Mary and Martha. You may remember Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus and listening to him, and Martha is puttering around in the kitchen making dinner. And she comes out and says, you know, Jesus, tell Mary to come in and help with the dish team. And Jesus commends Martha for what she's doing, but says that Mary has the better part. And this was taken symbolically, that the active life, the life out in the world, was the life of Martha, and the contemplative's life was the life of Mary, and that was the better part. Now, as we'll see, most of the true mystics were also very active in the world. But there was the via activa, the active life, vita activa, and the vita contemplativa, which was the contemplative life, the life in which one's devoted all one's energies to prayer to God. Other questions? All right, let's move on now to the modes of union. I mentioned that different mystics, mystical theologians, and of course, let me step back here and point out that a person could be a mystical theologian and never have a mystical experience. That is, theology is what's called a second-order activity. The mystical experience, the mystical practice, is a first-order activity. That's where something actually does something. And theology is reflection on what was done. And so someone like Eckhart, for example, who's a mystical theologian, I don't know whether he himself actually had mystical experiences. Most of the mystics who wrote, people like Teresa or Bernard or Hildegard, they were both mystical theologians. They wrote about their mystical experience, but they also had mystical experiences or themselves. Now, theologians disagreed on what was actually united at the highest stage of the mystical experience. And here, once again, what was primary was probably not the experience, but the linguistic system they were using to understand their experience. That is, if they were in a Neoplatonic tradition, they tended to stress that the intellect was the highest part of the human being, and the mystical experience was the knowledge of God, the intimate knowledge of God. And normally they use negative terms to describe this, knowing the unknowing, you know, going beyond the cloud of unknowing, the divine darkness, and so on. Let me give you an example from the founder of what was called speculative mysticism, which is the notion that the intellect was what's united. And this is Dionysius the Areopagite, who was thought to be an immediate disciple of St. Paul, who was referred to in the book of Acts on Mars Hill when Paul gives his sermon about the unknown God. And most people say that's very interesting and go away, but a few are converted, and one of them is Dionysius. It turns out Dionysius was really a 5th century Syrian priest, but he used the name Dionysius. He addressed his writings to a man named Timothy, and the tradition until the early modern period thought he was Paul's disciple. That gave him particular authority. And Dionysius is responsible for our notion of choirs of angels, for example, ranking all the different ranks of the choirs of angels. But here he writes and describes the mystical union of the intellect with the God which is beyond all predicates. He uses what's called the negative way, the via negativa. God is beyond both positive and negative affirmations. But thou, O dear Timothy, by the persistent commerce with the mystic visions, leave behind both sensible perceptions, here's the sense, and intellectual efforts, and all objects of sense. Objects of sense would be things you could touch, smell, or taste. And objects of intelligence, that would be ideas. And all things not being and being, that is, and be raised aloft unknowingly to the union, as far as attainable, with him, that's God, who is above every essence and knowledge. So God is beyond being, beyond what can be known. For by the restless and absolute ecstasy in all purity, from thyself and all, thou wilt be carried on high to the super essential ray of the divine darkness, when thou hast cast away all and become free from all. So God is described, and the union is described as being, as coming in union with the divine darkness, something that cannot be known by human beings, in a sense. It's knowledge beyond knowledge. That's one form of mysticism. The other is what's called affective. And here the union is with the will. It normally uses the positive way. And it believes that the human will becomes united for a short time with the divine will, which is love. This is the form of mysticism which draws heavily on the Song of Songs, you know, with the description of the bridegroom and the bride. We read it and we think of erotic poetry, and very good erotic poetry. They read it, however, as the bridegroom was Christ, or the Word, and the bride was either the perfected soul, which would receive the kiss of the bridegroom, or by extension, it could go either way, or it would be the church, or it would be the Blessed Virgin Mary. So it was read allegorically as referring to this union. Here is St. Bernard of Clairvaux on the love of God, speaking of the various stages. First, and excuse me for the non-inclusive language, it's Bernard's, not mine. First, therefore, man knows himself for his own sake, for he is flesh, and he can have no taste for anything except in relation to himself. So the first level of love is love of self. And when he sees that he cannot subsist of himself, that is, he can't live totally on his own, he begins to seek God through faith as something, as it were, necessary for him, and to love him. Thus he loves God according to the second degree, but for his own sake, not for God's sake. That is, the next stage is a love of God because it benefits you, the individual. But when, in truth, on account of his own necessity, he has begun to worship and come to God again and again by meditating, by reading, by prayer, and by being obedient, little by little God becomes known to him by experience, in a sort of familiarity, and consequently God grows sweet. And thus, by tasting how sweet is the Lord, the individual passes to the third degree, so that he loves God now not for his own sake, but for God's sake. And then the fourth degree, yes, in this degree, this is speaking of the third, he stands still for a very long time, and I know not if the fourth degree is attained in its perfection by any human being in this life, so that forsooth a man loves himself only for the sake of God. So that the ultimate would be to love God totally for God's sake. And that would be the highest. And the momentary union of that love leads to the ecstatic experiences described in some mystical literature. Yes?
Mark, does the word clairvoyant come from his hometown, St. Bernard of Clairvaux?
No. No, that's a good thought, but no. Clairvoyant just means clear seeing in the French. Yeah. I don't.
Mysticism, clairvoyant.
Yeah. It just was called Clairvaux. I don't. I don't think there's any, I don't know of any derivation. Bernard of Clairvaux, he was a Cistercian, and at Cistaux is where he first made his profession with 30 of his friends. He talked to all of his relatives and what have you to go with him at age 16 into the monastery. But then he went out and founded a new monastery at Clairvaux. So he has the name from the first of the Cistercian monasteries he founded. He founded in his lifetime some 60 monasteries, and directly founded and assisted in the founding of another 300. So, as we'll see in a moment, mystics are anything but passive. He also wrote some of the angriest letters of any Christian saint in chasing heretics around. He preached the Second Crusade. He intervened in the election of popes and of kings. He was a very busy man. As well as, he also cultivated Marian devotion and devotion to the passion, the humanity of Christ. Devotion to Mary and to the humanity of Christ are due to his preaching more than any other single individual in this period. He's an incredible person. So we have two types of union. One that I've associated with Dionysius, or also Meister Eckhart, which is the speculative union. It comes out of a Neoplatonic tradition. And normally the via negativa, the negative way, where the union is in darkness, beyond sense, and so on. And then the affective, the union of the will, which normally involves a positive way and stresses on love. And these are the two main traditions. Many variations, but the two main traditions within the West. Sometime the two will come together. Now, the mystical ascent itself. Here we're now entering into the life of prayer. In fact, for many mystics, they speak of the whole thing as a matter of different degrees of prayer. Although it varies from individual to individual, it's useful to categorize, that is, from mystical theologian to mystical theologian, it's useful to categorize it as essentially a three-stage process. There is the purgative, the illuminative, and the unitive. Let me unpack what each one of these mean. The purgative is the time in which one becomes, is the period during which the human being is active in subduing the body, subduing the senses, subduing the desires, learning to know oneself in order to transcend oneself. This is the period where humility, self-rejection, plays such a large role. This is the period that Naunen was talking about, you know, the rejection of the false self. It's the one in different stages where you control the body, normally through fasting and penitential discipline, including flagellation. Discipline the senses through deprivation and meditation. Prayer, which concentrates, mental prayer is practiced early in this stage, where you concentrate on certain images, for example, in the Passion, certain phrases, you know, God is love or the like. This is the period where the relaxation response would probably operate. So that's the first stage, and it's due to human activity. Towards the end of that stage, however, the mystic felt that God would have to intervene and begin to assist the individual in his or her prayer. So they would go from active to passive. And that transition moves us into the illuminative stage, where the human being is largely passive and God is the one acting, where the prayer is spontaneous. The prayer is not something one thinks about, it just sort of happens. And this is where one begins to taste the spiritual sweetness of God, or of Christ, the Word operating in the soul. This is as far as most people get, including most monks and nuns, much less most common people like us. But those who persist normally go through a period or a series of stages of dryness. The mystics talk about it over and over again. Periods where things don't seem to work, where the prayers don't happen, where the attention seems to wander, where the sweetness that one once tasted is no longer there, where you start wondering if God even exists or cares. The mystics insist that this is actually a sign that God is attempting to bring the human being to a higher level and will take the human being through this period of dryness. Sometimes it'll last for years before moving on up to a new stage. And so the spiral that Bonnie was talking about in Sojourn, you can hit a point in the spiral where nothing seems to be happening, or even there seems to be a backsliding and that you're not experiencing the sweetness of earlier on. But then at some point God, the mystic says, takes you, it's like preparing fallow ground, and then God moves you up into the unitive where you begin to experience God directly. The unitive is normally not sweet. The unitive experience in Christian mysticism is normally described with words like horror and terror, fear and trembling, pain and suffering. It is something that one does not... It's a terminology which would be off-putting, and yet the mystics who describe it are in no way... off-put. The only thing I can think of is the sexual orgasm, often the only word you can come to which is close, is words like pain, because it's a pleasure that is so intense. But they do talk about it being terrifying and of suffering and of illness and things that go along with it. And often scholars refer to passion mysticism. That is, what you're having here is a mystical union with the suffering Christ. Other language they use to describe this, there's bridal mysticism, where they use the language of the Song of Songs and talk about the marriage between the soul and Christ. There is maternal imagery that they use, sucking at the breasts of Christ. They actually mix male and female images. So Christ becomes female and with breasts that could offer milk. Or giving birth. Eckhart talks about the birth of the word in the soul. And the human being is, and the human soul is seen as female. Now, scholars that are reappropriating this for feminist theology have mixed feelings about this, because part of the reason they speak in female terms is not merely that it's bearing, that the thought is also that women are passive and the soul is passive at this point as it's bringing about the birth. At the top of this mystical ascent, there are various things that happen or can happen. They don't always happen. But there can be sense of rapture, out-of-body experiences, a sense of speaking with God, not audible, but somehow getting messages from God, a feeling of rushing about, and so on. Teresa, if you want to read, I think, book six or mansion six describes a lot of these experiences, and it's hard to tell sometimes whether she's a saint or a psychotic, given some of these expressions, but they seem to be common among mystics. And she herself had a very good sense of discerning the spirits. And let's move on now to that. These mystics, the mystical theologians, were no dumb bunnies. They understood that human beings, by not taking care of themselves, could become hysterical, by not eating enough, anorexia and so on, could have visions that seemed like mystical visions but were due, in fact, to chemical imbalances. They realized or believed that the devil could give one experiences and temptations. And so they developed a number of criteria for discerning the spirits. Let me mention three. First, in a true mystical experience, the human being is never completely swallowed up in the divine. The human being always retains his or her own individuality and distinction. If you're swallowed up, if you use images like swallowed up like a drop of water in the ocean, the Inquisition would jump down on you with both feet. Because the Inquisition and the Christian Church insisted that the creature, the uncreated divine and the creature were distinct and had to remain distinct. And there were reasons for this insistence, one of which was that if the individual soul is swallowed up in the divine, then what does immortality mean? Immortality, if one loses one's all that makes one a human being, all that makes one an individual, the immortality is meaningless. You follow the argument that if Christians believe that you have individual immortality, and so there was an insistence that there had to be the separation. So that is a distinction that you will find between Christian mysticism and some forms of Eastern mysticism, which talk about losing one's sense of identity. Secondly, the mystical union must lead to the sacraments and should not transgress the scripture or the teachings of the church. That is, a true mystical experience always and a true mystic remains in harmony with the church, avoids the schism. And what we'll find is that all of the mystics that have been recognized are also very much involved in the sacrament, especially the Mass. And particularly for women, the mystical experience was often around the Mass, the Eucharist. And finally, the mystical union must lead to an active life. One of the most common problems with mystics is what's called quietism. They live solely for the mystical experience. They have learned that they need to be passive in order for God to work in them, but they become passive in everything. On the contrary, the true mystic, according to the church and according to the mystical theologians, is driven by the experience out into the world to serve his or her fellow human beings. And that's why someone like Teresa, who reformed the Carmelite monasticism, formed a new monastery, by her death had founded 16 convents and 18 convents, 16 priories, and 80 were in place by 8 years after her death. Now she was no stay-in-the-corner recluse. In fact, one of her sayings, which I'm going to try to talk someone into, maybe I can get Linda Burgess to do it in calligraphy and put it up in the pit, was that God walks among the pots and pans. That the mystic is active in the world. So that quietism was another heresy. On the other side of quietism were those people who thought once they had united with the divine, they were beyond morality. And at least had the reputation of engaging in sexual excess and the like to prove that they had conquered the flesh and united with the divine. Whether there really were such people, we don't know, but the Inquisition burned a number of people on suspicion of this belief. Yes.
So the mystics are not really calling the church to a greater vision of, or just as you say, it's always in harmony with the church.
Yeah.
And leading to the sacraments. It wouldn't be like prophetic, say.
A mystic could be prophetic, yes, but. normally, it would not. Well, let's see. Even though being prophetic, it would not add to scripture and tradition, probably. That varies. Luther certainly would say that. I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of what their position was on people who claim to be prophets. Well, they burnt Joan of Arc, but that was the English, as a witch. Yes, they could go beyond. I'm thinking in the 19th century, there were several mystical visions of the Immaculate Conception, of the Virgin as the Immaculate Conception, and were cited in the Infallible Decree of 1854 on the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary, which is, of course, there is no source in Scripture for that. Although the church tradition had fought over that for centuries, for millennia. Let me mention then, I want to leave some time for discussion. I already mentioned Bernard of Clairvaux and read an excerpt. I mentioned Meister Eckhart. Let me read a bit more to you from Meister Eckhart. He was a Dominican, that is a follower of St. Dominic, an order of preachers, the same order as Thomas Aquinas. He was a speculative mystic. He was taught at the University of Paris, and also taught and preached in Cologne and Strasbourg. Late in his life, he was cited to Avignon for heresy, and he died before he was actually convicted, but a number of his writings were found heretical. People still fight about whether that is a fair decision or not. I'll let you judge. Let me read something to you. He is of the speculative sort, so his belief is that you have to transcend the body and the senses and all positive things that one can say about God. I find, he writes, that the highest virtue to be disinterest, that is, detachment from creatures. And he goes on to say it's higher than love, because love involves creatures, and higher from humility and so on. What is this disinterest, that it is so noble a matter? Know then that a mind unmoved by any contingent affection or sorrow or honor or slander or vice is really disinterested. So it's not moved by any of these emotions. Unmovable disinterest brings man into his closest resemblance to God. Now here you see the principle of likeness arguing, because he's going to argue that God is totally unmoved, passionless, disinterested. It gives God his status as God. His purity is derived from it, and then his simplicity and unchangeable character. If man is to be like God to the extent that any creature may resemble him, the likeness will come through disinterest. And man proceeds from purity to simplicity, and from simplicity to unchangeableness, and thus the likeness of God and man comes about. So here it is, throwing off all of the things that in fact make the individual an individual and reaching towards this union. The principle of likeness also finds expression in his argument that the ground of the soul, the human being, is also God. God actually dwells within the human being. And that the birth of Christ, the emanation out of the Godhead of the Word, occurs in all eternity. Not only out of God, but also inside of every individual human being. He writes, Where is he that is born King of the Jews? He asks the question. Now let us see where this birth takes place. It takes place in the soul, Christ, exactly as it does in eternity, and with no difference, for it is the same birth and occurs in the essence, the core of the soul. So he actually argues that God is within the human being, at the ground of the soul, there is God. And that the eternal birth of the Word, this is using a Neoplatonic notion of the Trinity, that occurs throughout all time, also occurs within the human soul. And the human being, by becoming like God, that is becoming unpassable, disinterested, can experience that darkness, which is found in the heart of every human being, that is of God and the eternal generation. I find this, I'm not a mystic at all, I find this really strange stuff. And I also can see why he got into trouble. Because pantheism, the notion, not making a distinction between God and the created things, seems to me a real danger here. Finally, there's Saint Teresa of Avila. And I will not say anything more about her, except to say that 1 through 3 are the purgative, 4 and 5 is the illuminative, and 6 and 7 are the unitive. And look for a number of these characteristics that we've talked about, those of you in the sojourn. I'd like to close, and still leave close to 20 minutes for either conversation or washing hands for dinner or whatever. I'd like to close with what Luther and Lutheranism has to say about mysticism. Luther tended to be quite suspicious about mystics and mystical claims. He objected on a variety of levels and grounds. He objected in part to the active role that the human being was seen to play in the mystical ascent, in the early stages of the mystical ascent. It was for him a species of works righteousness. That is, if you recall, Luther insisted that one is justified, saved by Christ, apart from anything that the human being does himself or herself. And the mystical ascent seemed far too active to Luther. It gave far too much credit to the human being and what the human being could do. He objected even more to the teachings about the uncorrupted ground, or the ground of the soul, that was like God, because that gave human beings a resource to save themselves, whereas he once again felt it was Christ, externos, outside of ourselves, that had provided for our salvation. He himself took the polemical opposite position, that Christ saves people who are unlike him. That is, Christ saves sinful human beings. And there's not, and that salvation comes despite the sinfulness, not because there is some little bit of goodness left in human beings, or not because that human beings have the potential of becoming good. God, in the person of Christ, saved people who were in fact sinful. He came for sinners, not for people who were perfect or on the way to perfection. He also personally had a run-in with a group of people known as the Zwickau prophets, who showed up in his doorstep claiming to have direct revelation from God that bypassed the Bible. He drew on the tradition to test their spirits, and specifically, he insisted that Scripture never, I mean, that prophecy never violates at least the essence of Scripture, which is the notion that you're saved by Christ alone. That was one test. The second test is an interesting one. If a person is a true prophet, he will suffer temptation, or she will suffer temptation, distress, and unwillingness to carry out the prophetic mission. He based this argument on the prophets in the Hebrew Scripture and on Paul and the apostles in the New Testament. They all, he said, suffered great doubts, great temptations, attempted to run away from the call, and so on. And then, since the Zwickau prophets showed none of these temptations or doubts, seemed to delight in the whole thing, he said they had to become from the devil. Luther elaborated on this point later on by saying that wherever you find the true church, there you will also find the devil. One of the marks of the true church is persecution. If you are not suffering doubts about your faith, if you are not being persecuted either spiritually or physically, you should probably reflect on whether you are a member of the true church, because Satan will not bother people who are already his. But Satan will give a real bad time to people who are potentially Christ's. So he saw persecution as the mark. At the same time, he recognized that there were true prophets and true mystical experiences. If they met these criteria, he would recognize individuals, because he realized that God had in the past spoken directly with human beings. Although Luther, when he actually does his exegesis, for example, the Hebrew Scripture, tends to have passages in the Hebrew Scripture where God speaks to a prophet. He argues that, in fact, that it's a human being speaking, that another individual, perhaps an older prophet, has come and spoken to the younger prophet. Luther believes generally that God chooses to work through the world rather than bypass the world. That's why he, among other things, he insists so that that Christ is really present in the sacrament of bread and wine. And he insists on the incarnation. He says that God chooses to communicate with us through the material world, which we can understand, and does not, as a general rule, go outside of it. But he did realize that occasionally God could speak directly to human beings, but then he used these various tests to discern the spirits. And these tests, by the way, are traditional. These are also the ones that are used by Catholics, for the most part. It is now 5:12 by my watch. Are there any questions, any comments, any objections?
One thing, Mark, that I don't know, my experience of reading the mystics and then also having read some psychology and some interested in the moral development of women being different than men, I think it needs to be stressed that women mystics and reading of the women mystics is much different than reading the men's or the male, the masculine
yep.
mystic. And you can really see the yin and the yang, or the getting of the ego, of having to keep the ego in the masculine mysticism, where in the feminine mysticism, it's trying to find an identity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Paul. That's very true. And in a patriarchal society, as the medieval and the early modern period was, almost the only role that a woman could have in of religious leadership was if she were a spectacular mystic. And there are a very large number of women who write of their mystical experiences, often as Teresa, under orders from their confessor. And they do describe a mysticism which is quite different in many respects, although still within the Orthodox sphere, quite different from male mysticism. If you want to read someone like Hildegard of Bingen, or Catherine of Siena, or Catherine of Genoa, or Teresa of Avila, although Teresa is in some ways less, she's more masculine in some of the imagery she uses. And then compare it with someone like Eckhart, you will see significant differences. The real scholar for this is a woman by the name of Carolyn Bynum, who has written a book, a collection of essays on Jesus' mother, and another one on Holy Feast, Holy Famine. And Holy Feast and Holy Famine, she examines how much food is involved in the woman's mystical experience and control over food, and how much the Eucharist and nurturing and maternal imagery is used. Once again, one's background, one's linguistic system determines how one understands the mystical experience. And the women tended to use certain imagery that you don't find as often in the men. Although you find in men a lot of feminine imagery as well. So that it's not so much that if you have a male mystic, it'll be one thing, and a female. It's rather there is sort of feminine and masculine mysticism, a spectrum, and you'll find some men over on the feminine side and some women over in the masculine side, and a lot in between. But I would recommend, if you want to read someone who is and has a very unusual, often confusing, but very unusual mystical view, read Hildegard of Bingen. In light of some of these comments.
Is Julian of Norwich?
Julian of Norwich is another woman, a mystic who uses a lot of feminine imagery for God. And she comes out of a different tradition than Hildegard, so you get a different slant at it. Yes, Jackie?
Is there any way, I don't know if it's possible, but to get a perspective for those of us who never get beyond the first level?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of time are you talking about that they might kind of be in that stage? Or, I mean, would they maybe, you know, hit the unitive maybe once or twice in their mystical career, or a lot, or...
Teresa argues that when you hit the in the seventh mansion, that's constant. The seventh mansion it's a certain awareness of God within, which accompanies the mystic through as the mystic works in the world, and you'd never lose that one. It's a constant presence. It's beyond the raptures and the ecstasy and so on. It's the marriage in the soul, and that one is constant. Now, she also experienced a lot of the raptures and what have you. If you've ever seen Bernini's Baroque statue of Teresa, where she's sort of going like this, it looks like she's in ecstasy, and there's the Cupid with the arrows, which is supposed to be the divine above it. It's very sexual. That's not a really appropriate depiction of. But she did have raptures and trances and things like that. But in the seventh stage, it's supposed to go. It's supposed to be constant. That's what she argues.
Yeah. Well, why is it so horrible and terrible and painful? And I think it's related to the Satan thing. But why is it so similar to being psychotic? How is it distinguished?
Ultimately we don't. She's dead, but. She herself, she talks about melancholy, which was the contemporary word for schizophrenic or manic depressive activity, and she knew what a melancholic was and had to deal with them among some of her nuns. And she had a period where she was paralyzed from the waist down for 3 years. I mean, she had a lot of medical symptoms that were suspicious from the modern, and some modern scholars have had fun psychoanalyzing her. She seems so level-headed. She herself knows what melancholy is and is able to distinguish it. She has certain tests. She leads such an active and productive life, even as she's undergoing all these experiences. If she's sick, that's the type of sickness that we all should have. Just a dynamo for doing good.
The first thing is that you're talking about the self-flagellation and that whole area. Now, my understanding of it, and that's, I guess I want to make it clear, that those don't come on. You don't, it's not something that happens, or it wasn't done purposefully, as it was, okay, I want to be a mystic, so I'm going to go through and do this kind of stuff. It's more of a case of mindset, or a condition that person
again, no, I would say on the contrary that many many monks and nuns did practice very severe discipline in the hope that they would have.
Okay, in the hope
that. There's a point at which that all that you do is irrelevant, because you only can ascend if at a certain point your own will becomes quiet, and God then moves.
Yeah, but I would say that probably St. Teresa or St. Francis, some of them, those stages that they went through at the beginning were not on their own free will, as it was something that of part of the depression and part of the feeling of self, denying self-worth.
They describe it in active terms, the early stages, and then talk about God taking over. Uh-huh. I mean, the famous story about St. Francis getting an erection and jumping in the rose bush to take care of it.
It's such a passion.
Yeah.
It's not something that's deliberate, it's a passion.
Yeah, and there's a book by a man named Bell called Holy Anorexia, which studies how many women may have been anorexic or bulimic in the monasteries in attempting to develop.
I was going to say, isn't that drives area that's done in the third stage.
Mm-hmm.
To be that prayer has actually become an addiction, and the more prayer, and so there is that dry spell because God is not going to be the addiction.
I think that's probably one way of describing it, that prayer suddenly loses its meaning, or they can no longer pray spontaneously, and they go through an arid, dry period.
Rich wants to talk to you.
Yes, Rich, sorry.
Some of the things you describe, like out-of-body experience, communicating with the divine, but not necessarily in words, a sense of presence, those sort of things,
mm-hmm.
they sound similar, almost identical to the kinds of things that a number of years ago people were describing when they were talking about this whole life after death concept of dying experiences and coming back to life, being revived.
Right.
Removing themselves from the accident scene, seeing their dead body going there, that kind of thing. What similarities and differences do you see? Can you compare the two and say a little bit about them?
I'm afraid I can't because I have never studied that. Some of the mystical theologians say nothing about these special experiences. Others, such as Teresa, describe them in quite startling detail. I don't know. I really don't know. They may be the same thing. They may not. I mean, in this case, I'm very much an academic. I have not experienced. I'm somewhere in the purgative at best. I mean, it sounds similar, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm more curious about similarities and differences.
We have so much literature over so many centuries that I think to deny that these experiences occur would be unwarranted. We could argue about the explanation for them. You know, is it oxygen deprivation? Is it all the endorphins in your system being released at once? Or is it the divine?
Mark, is this a valid contemporary process? Or are we just learning of this for historical reasons? And if it is a valid contemporary process, are there any acknowledged contemporary mystics?
Well, yes, there are. I think, take one who's Merton, who's deceased. I mean, there are a number of Christian mystics who have written about their experience. I think the critical reappropriation means that some of the assumptions underlying this, the description would change, and that so our mystic experience would be slightly different today. The discerning of the spirits is still used. Matthew Fox advocates what he calls creation spirituality and draws heavily on various mystics, has recently got into trouble with the Holy Office, or whatever it's now called, for a number of his statements, which are considered to be of questionable orthodoxy. I would agree that they are of questionable orthodoxy. I don't hold him up as an example. I think there are a lot of other better people who do speak of mystical experiences today.
What about Teresa of Calcutta?
Yeah, well, I don't know whether she's had. I mean, do you know? Yeah. Well, I mean, she's I think in her what she stands for in the world and what she's doing, she's a saint by most standards. But whether she's a mystic, I don't know.
Who are the women mystics today? We do know of Nowlin and Merton and mm-hmm. Fox. And who are the women?
May I ask some of you who may know?
Also, I'm right in the Christian tradition, but Simone Weil sticks out in my mind as mm-hmm. very much a mystic. I don't know, Dorothy Day?
Yeah, Dorothy Day might.
What about the...
I don't know if you read in her spiritual journey, she was not Christian, but she writes in a very similar way.
Mm-hmm.
Who? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Eddie Hillison,
Andy
Trevor, but that was also during
your
time
in
yeah.
the Holocaust.
That was
a I think probably there are more than we realize. They might use different language.
I think the mom of Jackie stepped away from the Christian scene. I, for the sake of argument, like to talk about the purgative experience, and maybe there are some similarities with the shamans, the Native American medicine people, priestesses, who many experienced some of the same kinds of psychotic passages that the Christian mystics did, mm-hmm. and they're of a more recent mm-hmm. heritage. But I don't know. I see a lot of similarities.
Well, I think, I mean, as I said in the outset, there are many different... it seems that most of the religious traditions have something analogous to what we're talking about here. But each one tends to experience and describe it differently. And I think the experience and the description are inseparable. The description determines the experience, and vice versa.
Don't you think that the nature of the experience being outside of our vocabulary makes it virtually impossible for each experience to be described?
Probably. But for example, many of the mystics will talk about, will actually have a mystic experience of the Trinity. I don't imagine you have very many shaman having an experience of the Trinity in mystical experience. We cannot escape language, and if you are dealing with the essentially that which is beyond language. That's why the via negativa is often attractive. But we think with, we experience with the language we know. And if we are coming out of a Christian tradition, that colors our experience. If it does not resonate sufficiently, then we may well dip into other experiences, other traditions that will resonate more with our sense of being. And I think many people do that. They move then beyond Christianity or away from Christianity or become eclectic and bring together Christian and non-Christian elements. And I mean, that, I think that's what Matthew Fox is doing. My main objection to Matthew Fox is not as his spirituality or his agenda. It's that he does violence to a number of the mystics he deals with, historical mystics. I mean, he distorts their teachings in the service of his own particular agenda. I mean, his goals are laudable. You know, end of patriarchy, a more creation-centered spirituality, and so on. Just I would like him to go about it a little differently. Any other?
Do you think it's deliberate on his part, or is it that his way of interpreting it?
Well, I don't know. He drops all sorts of nasty comments about academics who disagree with him. But, he certainly knows that the academic community thinks he's misreading.
Is that a sign of a prophet or not?
Well, I would hope our prophets would be more profound. He says silly things, too. I mean... for example, in his pictures from of Hildegard of Bingen, a lot of her illustrations, he sees Hopi corn signs in some of the illustrations, and he says, well, of course, the Celts have been to America, and they must have brought this back, and isn't it natural to assume that since she's so interested in Celtic religion that she would have had this, and so it's deliberately there. Well, that's bullshit. excuse my... but. Yeah, I know. You got me. I mean, it's one thing to say that there are parallels, another to say preposterous things like that. And he does things like, at one point he says, Hildegard's favorite color is green, and look at the green in this painting. Well, in the original it's gold, and he's reproduced it as green. Well, you can't do that. I mean, all it takes is one person to check the original, and you're in trouble. Things like that. Time to eat.